What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off. Jay Kwon is the founder and CEO of Tendermint. In this conversation, we discuss consensus algorithms, game of stakes, nation-state surveillance, climate change, cow farts, life on Mars, and liquid solid states of matter. I really enjoyed this conversation, and Jay has very unique views of the world. I hope you enjoy it nearly as much as I did. Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only. All right, guys, bang, bang. I'm here with Jay. We got a lot to cover. We're going to go super deep on the environment. He's going to teach me some stuff. I'm going to argue with him, and you guys are going to learn. So thank you so much for coming.
You're going to try to make me mad, right?
I could try to make you mad about the environment, but I don't know enough about the environment. We could argue like sports or something, and then maybe I could win. But
I can't talk about sports. I don't watch it.
All right, what's your background?
Background? Computer science education from Cornell, graduated in 05. I've been in San Francisco for about 12 years doing development, a lot of open source development. And I wrote the Yelp iPhone app a while back, and that gave me, through the shares in the company, some freedom to explore a variety of projects, like 3D printing at some point, lots of open source projects, played a lot of poker. We could talk about that.
Are you any good?
I'm good, but my problem is I like to play at higher stakes than I should. So that's what I learned about myself.
Got it.
And yeah, that got me to quit. So there's that.
You play high stakes, it only matters if you lose a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It does matter, yeah. But what else? I care a lot about privacy. So the Snowden revelations got me interested into programming end-to-end encrypted communication systems. I love distributed systems and complex emergent phenomena. So a lot of my background kind of got me into the Bitcoin space early on in 2013. And I've been working on a proof-of-stake consensus system called Tendermint. And now, starting from 2017, a network of blockchains, this vision for an interconnected blockchain network that will solve the scalability problem and a host of other problems for the cryptocurrency space called Cosmos.
All right. We got a lot to go over.
Uh-huh.
First, San Francisco, what's up? Why is everybody leaving?
Why is everyone leaving?
Because you've been there 12 years. Why are you still there?
Good question. Been busy. I've been kind of meaning to. I want to live in New York and be bi-coastal.
You want to leave?
I kind of want to leave. Yeah.
Like it's becoming cool to leave.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a hipster or anything, but I have a dog and I walk my dog on the sidewalk in the Mission.
And, I was just going to say the Mission's like Brooklyn, basically.
I haven't really lived in Brooklyn, so okay, you tell me.
But, just trust me.
Okay, yeah. I mean, my dog steps into human poop, you know.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
It's kind of gross.
Yeah, and then you pay a lot of money to live there, so that doesn't help the fact that not only is it maybe not the cleanest, but what's going on? All right, let's talk about Snowden and privacy.
Okay.
And Julian Assange and all that.
Okay.
Nobody's came on and talked about it yet. Mm-hmm. Why are you so excited about it? Like, what was the fascination with it all?
Well, I've always had a problem with authority, you know, and so I like to create and be part of voluntary systems that allow me to, you know, dictate my life and who sees my information. And Snowden revelations were quite revealing about to the extent to which we're being surveilled, and I think. That's going to have ramifications eventually down the line where we're going to be living in an authoritarian regime, whether it's through a government or a collection of companies, you know, fascist corporate dictatorship, something like that.
Do you think it's the future or do you think we're already doing that?
We're already there and we're trying to create a better future. We'll see.
What was the biggest thing that like upset you in all the revelations? Was it the participation of companies? Was it just the government's kind of arrogance in it all? Or what was the kind of the thing that caught your attention?
It's like everything we learned about and starting from school, say, like about the greatness of America, just all seemed like a lie, you know, like we're living in a matrix and we're part of a program that we don't even understand or get to control. You know, I mean, they call it a democracy, but we didn't vote for the system. And the money that you use is controlled and issued by corporations, private banks, and a cartel of them called the Fed, right? And you don't get to decide where the government, our humanity or civilization gets to divert or invest in terms of our resources. Now we're facing a huge environmental problem, and look at where we are, you know? I didn't choose this. I don't think my parents chose it. So why are we here?
Yeah. What, in all of that, do you think the U.S. is better or worse on their surveillance side than other countries?
In terms,
China obviously is like really, really bad, but just take any other country than like the ones that are obviously bad.
Uh-huh.
Where do you think U.S. is? Are we high on the list, kind of from middle of the pack? Are we actually doing better?
I don't know the answer to that, you know, but like one thing that scares me about this is a story I heard recently about someone in China, and this guy was riding a bicycle, crossed the street lights without stopping, and a camera took a photo, a picture of his face, and then sent him a ticket at home. Like, that's crazy, you know, that everything you're doing is being tracked by AI and analyzed. So yeah, China's already there.
I agree that the facial recognition is like weird, right? Mm-hmm. And that probably definitely makes me uncomfortable. But the repercussion of you broke the rules and got a ticket for it, I'm not so worried about, right? In the sense of if there was a cop there, right, technically they could write the ticket.
Oh yeah, the ticket's fine. I don't mind the ticket. Yeah, charge it out of my credit cards
That becomes scary is if then because you did that, you can't go in a certain part of the city. You can't take out a loan, or
don't know everything
your kids
about
can't go
you
to a certain school.
By association, don't know what you're thinking, don't know what you're planning. And so, you know, we're entering the era of like pre-crime, you know, and they'll stop movements or insurrections. You know, stopping that sounds okay, but they'll stop other things too.
Right? Describe a pre-crime for the people that don't know.
Okay, so before you commit a crime, some advanced technology that predicts that you will commit the crime, and so before you even do it, you're locked away, essentially, so you prevent it from doing the thing. Yeah.
You're on the way to rob the bank. You haven't robbed the bank yet, but you get stopped, and you basically get charged with breaking the law, even though you didn't do it yet.
Yeah, and so, all right, I don't want to live in that world. You know what the U.S. is good at? I don't know if the U.S. is as, like, if they have as much technology in terms of, you know, tracking people, but they're very good at parallel reconstruction. So, you know, they have a different set of skills, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How good's the encryption technology right now? You think that it's actually protected?
I'm not the best cryptographer, so I can't really answer that. But I see that there are new vulnerabilities being discovered all the time. I think the name of the game nowadays is trying to infiltrate algorithms or like devices. One of the things I hear about is compromising the random number generator that's inside our devices, right? So that's an easy way to compromise cryptography without dealing with compromising the algorithm itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's pretty crazy that we're sitting here talking about like how good is end-to-end encryption in the context of like a surveillance state, and the richest man in the world literally has pictures floating around.
Is that Bezos?
Yeah, just like the fact that he's got more money than God, mm-hmm. right? And can hire every cryptographer in the world. He can get all as much security as he wants, but pictures still get out, right? Mm-hmm. Things he's doing that he probably didn't want people to know about still mm-hmm. get out. And
I like that. I like that it got out, you know, and that he couldn't control it.
Well, and look, I don't know all the details of it, right? But I don't know if it was actually somebody hacked his phone or, you know, he sent the pictures and then they kind of got socially engineered, right? In terms of somebody eventually got the photos because of that. But it's just this idea that, like, no matter how good the tech is, there's always a nefarious actor who potentially can beat it, mm-hmm. right? And then there's also the human component, right? Mm-hmm. You see all like the SIM swapping in crypto, for example. People put, you know, multiple layers of security on their mobile phone accounts. And there's, you know, they literally put notes in there that say, no matter what, even if I come in, do not give a SIM card out to anybody. Mm-hmm. And they still give it out because it all gets socially engineered, right? Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with the technology systems. It has to do with the fact that there's still a human there as a failure point, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I agree.
Which is pretty crazy. All right. So talk to me about Tendermint. What is this consensus algorithm? We have one. We have Bitcoin. Why do we need
Bitcoin's
another one?
Bitcoin's great. Yeah, and I'm not going to knock Bitcoin. I love Bitcoin. You know, proof of work was like a necessary step for people to understand the need for a widely distributed BFD consensus system, right? But what the problem is that the security of the system is really expensive in terms of energy expenditure. And what the Bitcoin maximalists or proof of work maximalists will say is that it's useful work because it's there to secure the system. But the response to that is, well, it's wasteful if there are alternatives that can do better without spending that much energy. You know, then even though it's useful, it's clearly wasteful.
So your argument is, I'm going to go to the extreme side and say, if there was full feature parity or security parity, right? Both systems were completely secure and there was the same cost in terms of, in order to have a secure system, you as an actor within that system had some sort of cost associated with your participation. You're saying that having a proof of work system in that case is wasteful compared to a proof of stake system or some other consensus model. My understanding, and again, you're 1,000 times smarter than me, is that the proof of stake and other consensus algorithms are either not at parity on the security side or on the different criteria, or they're not as proven, right?
Proof of stake is not as proven.
Okay.
Even Tendermint, I have to admit, it's an experiment. We haven't had the system work, you know, and when you deploy something in a social context, like really anything could happen. So who mm-hmm. knows? But I wouldn't say that there's parity in okay. security, but I like the way you phrased it. It's about the cost of launching an attack, right? And there's definitely a cost that can be proven about what would happen to an attacker who forks, say, a Tendermint blockchain. It's like when there is a double spend attack on a Tendermint chain, it means that there's a way to punish at least one third of the stakeholders. What that means is it's kind of as if you launch a 51% attack on Bitcoin, their mining hardware explodes and it's gone. You know, that's quite the expense in terms of launching an attack. Whereas in today with proof of work, the only cost there is the ongoing electricity costs for like an hour or however many hours. So potentially proof of stake based on classical BFD algorithms like Tendermint can be more secure than proof of work.
So walk me through the Tendermint algorithm in layman's terms, right? So for a dummy like me, explain how the consensus algorithm is different.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to go into like how the algorithm works because I've tried that and it's just like, so I have to admit, consensus systems is very difficult even to explain. But the gist of it is you have a set of actors and they can have different voting power relative to each other, but they all have public private keys and they're signing messages in a gossip protocol. And there's a round robin set of rounds where they need to come to consensus ultimately. It's a two-phase commit algorithm, which means there's one phase where they vote and then a second phase where based on what they saw of everyone vote, they vote again. And if there's more than two-thirds voting in favor of a block in the second phase, then that's a commit. That's proof that everyone will, that everyone who is honest will eventually arrive at the same conclusion. Yeah.
And so really what you're doing is why the two phases, is it just gets to a deeper level of clarity or kind of a more agreeable state?
There's just no way to really make this work with just one phase, and to try to explain that, I think I tried once, couldn't quite do it.
Okay, like,
why? Yeah.
All right. So you have the Tendermint consensus algorithm. You built that or started working on it in what, like 2014?
2014. So I started working on trying to solve the nothing at stake and proof of stake problem in 2013. And I saw BitShares and NXT and the theoretical limitations or the holes, you know, I couldn't figure out and prove. It was pretty clear that you could not prove that there is a guaranteed cost to launching an attack. Mm-hmm. So I tried to find a better solution. I couldn't. So I put that down and tried to create a cryptocurrency exchange to compete with Cripsy. Worked on that for 6 months. Understood the regulations around like statewide, you know, and international regulations around securities and all that. And then when I was about to launch it, I chanced upon some papers that described all the academic approaches to Byzantine fault-tolerant consensus algorithms. And I found this one 1988 paper by Dwork, Lynch, and Stockmare, and it had all the components that that convinced me that proof of stake could absolutely be solved. So I dropped everything and started working on that. So Tendermint, yeah, has been going on since 2014.
Byzantine fault-tolerant systems. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people hear that phrase and they repeat that phrase because they think it sounds smart. I just sounded smart saying it and I felt good about myself.
Yeah.
What does it mean?
Okay. Byzantine just means arbitrary behavior. Like when you run a program, you're supposed to run that program. But when you do something else, then that's Byzantine behavior. Collusion is also a subset of Byzantine behavior if you're deviating from what you're supposed to do. And even just crashing and not participating is also Byzantine behavior. And that's called a crash fault, for example, in consensus literature. So it's not possible to create like a consensus system like Bitcoin or Tendermint that can tolerate, 99.9% of Byzantine actors. Yeah? But it is possible to create one that can tolerate a fraction. In Bitcoin, that's 49%, say, and in Tendermint, that's 33%. And, why those are different, it gets into technical details. But the idea is that Tendermint, you can tolerate up to 33% of the voting power trying to attack the system or deviate from the original protocol or just crashing, and the blockchain will still work fine.
And then you took Tendermint consensus algorithm, mm-hmm. and you've applied it, and talk about Cosmos and what the heck that is.
Okay. Do you remember the Bitcoin sidechains paper?
I do not know.
Okay. What it is, it's not
and
the best
people
way
listening
to start.
Definitely don't remember.
Okay. So, the cryptocurrency has a scaling problem, I would say. There's the Lightning Network. I love the Lightning Network and the work that's been put in there. But there's also some issues with it. There's capital lockup costs. And it's also not a generic or general solution to all kinds of blockchains, and especially not like Ethereum smart contracts, right? So the general an easy way to solve the scalability problem would be to have many parallel blockchains that are running all at the same time. Then the question is, how do you coordinate between all those blockchains? If you have 1,000 blockchains, we already do, right? But what that means is, in order to use one blockchain, like blockchain A, you need to get tokens there. If you want to use blockchain B, you need to get B tokens. So if you have A tokens, but you want to use B, you have to go to an exchange. You can do an atomic swap, right? It would be better if we can just have the same token, somehow transfer it to the other blockchain and use the logic that's on that other blockchain, right? And this is, you can do this through two-way pegging, right? And the Cosmos network is about connecting all of these blockchains together in a hub and spoke like fashion, all powered by classical BFT consensus algorithms like Tendermint, such
BFT
that
BFT is the Byzantine fault tolerant.
Yeah, Byzantine fault tolerant. Thank right. you. Yeah,
I'm making progress over here.
All right, done it. And so, yeah, the Cosmos hub just launched. It's a multi-asset proof of stake blockchain powered by Tendermint. And its job is to connect to many other Tendermint power blockchains such that you can transfer, quote unquote, tokens through two-way pegging. So this is how we're going to solve the scalability and interoperability problem and how we're going to create a new foundation for a scalable token economy.
Got it. Two-way peg. Explain that a little bit.
Okay. Let's see. So I'm going to try two approaches to explain this. But
okay.
One is, this is from the Bitcoin sidechains paper. If you can move your tokens, your Bitcoins, to a multi-sig address. And that multi-sig address could be controlled by signers on another blockchain, say. So that's a sidechain. And it can have its own logic. It could be UTXO chain or an EVM chain. And so anyone can move their Bitcoins to there by transferring, you know, your Bitcoins to a multi-sig address. You can do whatever you want on that chain, and then you or whoever you gave those coins to can withdraw, right? So that's the idea of a two-way peg in Bitcoin. We also see this in the banking world with Nostro accounting. So banks between banks, the way banks hold accounts within each other is also a kind of two-way peg, I would say.
Got it. And a lot of people like this Cosmos project. Like, there's people really pumped that they are that you guys launched this. Mm-hmm. What to the detractors? What's the detractors' argument? Like, the people who are seem to be in the minority, at least in terms of you know, public sentiment. Why don't they like it?
Okay, I mean, there's a whole slew of reasons why people don't like it. But, like, there are proof-of-work maximalists who don't like the fact that we're creating a proof-of-stake system. There's, like, Bitcoin maximalists or any coin maximalists that just don't like the fact that we're another chain, right? Mm-hmm. And there are people who are creating competing systems, say. You know, I mean, in some sense, there are competing systems who just try to knock us down because we're the first.
Mm-hmm. And can you, in the steady state, is the belief that you could make every chain interoperable with each other?
Just about, yes.
Mm-hmm. But the proof of work chains could not participate.
It's harder. It's a bit more difficult. Yeah. So the beauty of Tendermint and you know, classical BFT algos is that it's very easy to prove to a light client like your phone that something really happened on that blockchain. This was the block hash that was committed. And it's very quick because all you need to do is wait for a set of signatures to be created by the consensus set or the validator set, and then as long as you know the original validator set, you can quickly verify it by verifying the signatures. In proof of work, it's more difficult because you have to first wait for additional confirmation blocks to come, and then there's also issues around eclipse attacks and so on. Turns out, you know, that Tendermint and BFT systems that are like Tendermint are better for cross-chain communication because like client proofs is essentially how cross-chain communication is done in Cosmos.
Where does this game of stakes come in? I heard about this. Do you guys create this, or somebody else created it on top of the project?
Yeah, we administrated the Game of Stakes program.
That was a very political answer. It's fine. I'll let you get away with it. There's PR people in the room.
All right.
Yeah. So explain what it is, and then we can talk about why you guys did it.
We like to be safe. You know, safety first is our, not our mantra, you know, but we say that quite a lot. Like, Tendermint is safety first. Before we launch a blockchain, we want to be sure that everything is kind of ready, right? So we wanted to first get the validators going, the validator community, in terms of getting them used to the process of launching this chain. We also wanted to test for the economic model to make sure that it's not just going to crash and burn as soon as you launch it, which would be like a PR disaster, right? We tried to incentivize all kinds of attacks. And what we found was there was a cartel that formed. Bitfish had a whole bunch of people sign up as validators when they signed up for the Game of Stakes program. And we found that the community was able to identify them and kind of fork them out because they were trying to be malicious.
So really what you're essentially doing is you're incentivizing people to trust no one. And everyone kind of check everyone else.
Yeah, the community should trust. Well, they certainly shouldn't trust any central point. You know, like even don't trust me. Don't trust our company. Don't trust the foundation.
Forget calling it Game of Stakes. You should have just called it paranoia.
Paranoia. Like, Yeah, I mean, aren't you paranoid? You know, isn't?
Oh, I'm not using it as a bad thing. No, right. I mean, look, the whole idea of not trusting anyone, right? Trust no one, but verifying everything. I think it has a lot of validity to it.
It can go a little too far. Yeah.
Does Game of Stakes go too far?
No, I don't think it went too far. You know, maybe it could have been pushed a little too far. But
for the people that are playing, like, how much economic benefit is there for them? They win like $20 or
there were 50 winners, so they got tokens that they can validate. I forget the exact amount, but it wasn't insignificant. And they also get to say that they participated and won. So yeah,
were they doing it for the notoriety or for the money?
For both.
For both.
Yeah,
all right, that's fair. Yeah. All right, let's talk about the environment.
Okay.
How the hell does crypto and blockchain solve the environmental problems? Well, hold on. What are the environmental problems?
Okay, the environmental problems. Okay. I mean, there's a whole lot, right?
Are there?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. Climate change is a huge one based on the amount of greenhouse gases and carbon dioxide that are in the air, right?
Where do those come from?
Mostly fuel, right? Gasoline and coal, right? And now from the destruction of the ecosystem, you know, just the ecosystem is producing it too.
So I don't claim to be well educated on the environmental front, but I have heard, and then I've also heard the opposite, that a lot of the CO2 that is emitted into the air and causes a lot of the global warming and climate change comes from cow farts.
Methane. Yeah.
Methane, right?
Methane is a huge deal.
That's like a real thing.
It is a real thing, but I don't think that's much compared to, you know, overall the rest of the carbon dioxide that we're emitting. If you calculate like how many barrels of oil we're pumping out into the atmosphere, it's disgusting. Because eventually we have to figure out a way to either stop doing that, but not only stop doing that, but figure out a way to put that back into the soil. You know, and it's really daunting. It's on the scale of like everyone trying to build like a Great Wall of China or something. It's a monumental task that I don't see happening until we get our shit together very soon.
All right. Last question about the climate change. It's like not cool to call it global warming anymore. It's like now the terminology is climate change. Is that a thing, or is that just my perception?
I feel like
incorrect?
Maybe. I mean, because like part of the problem is that it shifts global weather patterns. So some places are colder. I think the Midwest, for example, was like flooding, and there's like winter storms going on when there shouldn't be. So climate change makes more sense. But overall, it's certainly about global warming. Although, just climate change too. It affects agriculture, so we're going to see food shortages pretty soon.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. We're already seeing some of that from the U.S., but I believe within, say, 10 years, it's going to be affecting us and it will be on our minds.
Describe more about the food shortages.
Well, with climate change comes, you know, the unpredictability of climate. Like, the crops aren't used to the crazy weather patterns where like droughts are worse and the floods are worse and so on. So we're going to see food shortages.
What about like demand. Indoor farming? Does that solve
if you're some farming
of it? Indoor farming, vertical farming? Again, those are big words. Not really big words, but they make me sound and feel smarter. So I'm going to throw those out there at you.
All right, man. You do you, dude. I think it might help. But I mean, if you're talking about like a hydroponic setup where you have like light bulbs and everything, you know, I don't really see that helping out. It's just probably going to make things worse. I think it might help, but that's a lot of indoor farming, you know.
Yeah.
We don't have the infrastructure.
It'd be
hard
to replicate the entire U.S. food system indoors in a vertical farming.
In a vertical farm, yeah. 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 Yeah.
All right. And then what about...
I do think people should go out and live and figure out how to produce food for themselves. I think that'll help out a lot, you know, and ensure our survival at least.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because I'm going to take it a step further.
That's good.
Do you know about Ted Turner with the bison?
Tell me about it.
So Ted Turner is he's the founder of CNN, a bunch of other stuff, right? Rich dude. Mm. And he's one of the largest landowners in the United States. Mm. And he has been a big believer in, I'm pretty sure that he's a big believer in food shortage being on the horizon. He has been that way for like literally decades. And the reason why he owns so much land is he made a very concentrated effort to try to prevent the extinction in North America of bison.
Great.
And like I guess, breeds them, right? I don't remember all the details, but he's like super into that. So he's not just trying to figure out how do you make food for yourself, but how do I feed people in general?
Yeah. It sounds like he's trying to terraform the earth when it's needed. Well,
he's a billionaire. So, he's got a lot of money to play around and do things that he thinks are good for the world, I guess. But,
you know, like that's kind of, yeah, the way we do farming now, right. There's all this private land. Animals can't roam there anymore. But there was a TED talk, I forget by who was saying, one of the best ways we can increase carbon capture on soil is to ensure that there's, wildlife and plants in the grasslands. The best way to do that, apparently, is to actually have bison or cows or bulls or whatever, like urinate on the ground and stomp, things and make sure things rot properly. So, going back to the basics of creating new that ecosystem, I think is super important.
Oh, you mean letting nature do the natural things that they do would be a good thing?
The thing that it's been doing forever, yeah. And you know what? The cool thing is I think we can incentivize this. If you take a look at a project called Regen, for example, Regen. Right. It's about measuring carbon in the soil, and ultimately about incentivizing the improvement of that soil. So I think the first thing we need to do in order to improve anything is to measure and to observe and to see what's going on, and then with the blockchain, we could create an incentivization system. Imagine if in the future, with enough knowledge and information about what's going on and understanding of the solutions needed, I think people would want to support, say, a stable coin that perhaps might incentivize the creation of that infrastructure to make it happen. So I think education goes a long way, as well as measuring. Yeah.
What about the oceans?
What's going on
with the oceans?
I know there's too much overfishing.
Overfishing meaning that we're catching too much fish and taking them out of the ecosystem, and the oceans are suffering because of it.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think recently, I don't remember the exact numbers, but like within a span of just a few decades, almost like within our parents' lifetimes, destroyed 90-something% of the fish population. And then people say, yeah, 90-something%.
Right? It's a lot of sushi.
It's a lot of sushi. Yeah, exactly. There's also issues around like pollution, right? So we don't do a good job figuring out how to manage pollution. There's plastics going into the ocean all the time.
I was going to say, you see the whale that they found all the tens of pounds of plastic in his stomach?
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy.
It is. I don't know. That makes me sad.
Yeah. I mean, I think it killed the big one that like was a big story, right? I think it killed the whale and it had a lot to do with the plastic or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there like a whole island like the size of Texas? I'm sure. Like a contiguous plastic island.
Yeah.
But
it all kind of gets together.
Yeah.
I mean, we definitely don't know nearly enough about the ocean, right? I think everyone agrees on that. So this is where I'm just more experienced than you at sitting here and talking into this microphone that I'm going to show you that I just expertly walked you from CO2 and global warming to the oceans, because now we're going to talk about seaweed.
Seaweed.
You know anything about seaweed?
I know what it tastes like.
Yeah, okay.
It's great. And if you feed it to the cows, I hear it's good.
So, you know something about seaweed with the cows. All right. So, what is this true that there's a certain strain of seaweed that if you put it in cow feed, it can actually drastically reduce the CO2
emission? I haven't tested myself, but it's probably true. Why would anyone lie about that, right? Red seaweed or something like that?
Yeah.
It will reduce methane emissions from cows, yeah.
The only reason I know this is because somebody tried to get me to invest in their seaweed farm, which sounds like, we're like go farm, but it's in the ocean.
Is it in the ocean?
Because you have to make the seaweed.
I wonder if you can make a seaweed farm like right in Manhattan.
So, all right, now we're really getting off topic here, but it's interesting to me. What I wanted them to do was to create like a vertical farming type situation, but do it for seaweed. Mm-hmm. So it's more like a aquaponic vertical farm, and you could grow the seaweed in like a local swimming pool. You could grow it in a factory or a warehouse, wherever, because part of growing the seaweed offshore, right, to some degree, is the transportation costs. Mm-hmm. there's not a lot of cows at the beach. Mm-hmm. So you got to get the seaweed somewhere to get it processed and get mm-hmm. it into the feed. And so I always thought that, like, man, if vertical farming is going to be a thing and the seaweed thing's real, I'm sure you can make a lot of money by creating some kind of vertical farming seaweed.
Yeah. Or we could just put a tax on cows.
Why?
Wow.
You eat meat?
It's easier. Yeah, I still eat beef. I have to admit. Yeah, cows. Eat
chicken?
I eat chicken, yes.
All meat?
Almost all meat.
If we tax, why do you want to put a tax on?
Well, then it would get me to eat less. I have to admit, sometimes I have some impulse control issues where I'm like, you know, I just want to eat that thing. I admit, and everyone I think has this issue. But if we make it more expensive, I mean, cow meat wasn't all that accessible to everyone, you know.
Yeah,
it's not inconceivable to think that it might become more expensive.
What about the fake meat, like Impossible Meats and all these?
Have you tried the Impossible Burger?
I've tried it.
It tastes okay. It's all right. Yeah. But like, I just don't know if it has like the right nutritional profile, right? So I don't want to eat it every day.
I'll defend them in the sense that going into it, I thought it was going to be really bad. It was actually better than I thought, but it still didn't taste like, you know, a McDonald's burger, right? Which might not be meat either.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. It's more like a sponge. But like, are they going to sue me now? No, right? Hey,
watch out,
Calvin. It depends on who cooks that Impossible Burger meat. So you just have to find a restaurant that can actually do it well, because apparently you need like a different kind of oven for it.
You know why soda, like Coca-Cola, tastes better at McDonald's than other places?
I have noticed that, but I don't know why.
Because they follow the recipe exactly, and other people dilute it, right? They put like too much water and stuff in the syrup, because most of the restaurants make it on the spot.
Yeah.
And so like maybe meat's the same way, where the Impossible Burger, then when they send it to you, if you don't follow the directions, it doesn't taste as good.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, most people don't have the right oven for it. So it comes out with like not, you know, medium rare, right? Mm-hmm. It'll come out to be too overcooked. Yeah.
That makes sense. All right. So how the hell does blockchain solve this stuff?
How do you go from topic to topic like that? That's amazing.
That's just how my brain works.
Yeah. Wow. Do you have like a mind map in your head where you can see the next topic?
Well, I wanted
topic?
To talk about seaweed, and I got you to talk about that.
Okay. Sorry. What's the next topic?
Talk about blockchain and crypto. How does that solve the environmental stuff?
Okay. So I think, you know, the ICO bubble that we saw showed that it can solve at least the incentivization problem of incentivizing new approaches to solutions to problems, right?
Okay.
I mean, we tried to do fundraising for a project to create like a blockchain platform a while back, and approached a lot of blockchain VCs for it, and they didn't get it. But what we found is that the public does. The ones that were tracking our project have capital and were willing to fund it. And so when we conducted a fundraiser in 2017 for Cosmos, it was quite a surprise and shock to see that just how much demand there was.
How much did you guys raise?
We put a cap on it. So we said we wanted to raise $10 million. And we said if there's enough demand within the first 6 hours, we'll cap it at 17. And then we closed that in 29 minutes. And this is
Time out. What? You raised $17 million in 29 minutes?
Yeah.
It's almost $1 million a minute. I'm not a mathematician, like, but it's
and people in California at least had to wake up at 6 a.m. So they're also punctual people.
How many people came from California?
I don't really know. And at the time, it was like the most amount of like ether raised for a project. Mm-hmm. And since then, we've had larger amounts. But you know, by the way, I do think that like raising $1 billion or whatever for a project is kind of insane. Yeah, I'm glad the SEC is putting a stop to that.
A lot of founders don't realize that everyone knows that if you don't have enough money, mm-hmm. right, you kind of starve the company and it can fail. Mm-hmm. But you also can die of overeating to mm-hmm. some degree if you mm-hmm. raise too much money. Somebody once told me, they're like, look, no matter how much money a founder raises, they spend it in 18 months. Right?
18 months, yeah.
So if they raise $1 million, they make it last, you know, 12 to 18 months. If they raise $250 million, they blow through it in 12 to 18 months. And if you look, like 2017, right, was kind of when all the craziness happened. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of projects that raised a lot of money, mm-hmm. you know, tens of millions of dollars, that are running out of money now.
Mm-hmm.
We're about 18 months later, mm-hmm. right? And so mm-hmm. it's pretty interesting to see that phenomenon play out with teams that raised $15, $20, $50 million, and you know, they have nothing to show for it.
Well, what do they do with it? Like, I think we're maybe spending money too slowly, so maybe we should accelerate that. But yeah.
Let's talk about VCs when you went to go pitch them. I'm fascinated by the idea that you went to go pitch, quote unquote, professional investors who are all contrarian, obviously. Mm. And
no, they're not. No, they're momentum seekers, right?
Of course.
They seek patterns, yeah.
And instead, the crowd obviously was very interested in what you guys were doing, but the venture capitalists were just not confident enough to put capital to work. Mm-hmm. What do you think their big concerns were, or like, why do you think they had kind of a shyness in terms of investing?
Well, they knew about Bitcoin,
okay,
but they didn't understand why proof of stake mattered.
Okay.
So, yeah. Whereas the people who were tracking a project were excited about the proof of stake aspect. Mm-hmm. I just think in general, I mean, and there are contrarian VCs and those who are on the bleeding edge. But, you know, if you can be bleeding edge like that, maybe it's just more fun to be participating and building it. Right. So maybe that's the reason.
Can you tell me a great story about a venture capitalist that did something stupid during the fundraise process, but don't use their name? Do you have any good stories about things that... You're smiling right now and people can't see you, so I know you have great stories. You have to tell me one of them.
Did something stupid.
No names.
No.
Just like when you were sitting there, you're just like, this is surreal, the fact that I'm here pitching a company that is highly technical and has all this prospect and should fit into somebody's thesis.
Sorry, blanking. Let's move on.
You're lying, but it's okay. All right. So when you raised the money, no equity, right? It was just a traditional ICO in terms of non-dilutive capital, or how did it work?
Well, we never called it an ICO. We called it a fundraiser. Okay. And it was structured as a donation modeled after the Ethereum Foundations.
Okay. How does that work? A donation?
Well, we explicitly say it's a donation and that we'll create the software, but that, you know, you don't have rights or anything or mm-hmm. claims. And we'll recommend a Genesis distribution and so on, but that it's really up to the community to take the software and do something with it, which is mm-hmm. what happened. We had a distributed launch. Neither the foundation nor the software company, Tendermint, ran validators. Mm-hmm. And yet the blockchain launched with 67 validators and now has 100 or so.
Yeah. Wow. And do you know who the validators are, some of them, like in terms of, are they individuals? Are they organizations?
A lot of them are organizations. They're software companies or crypto hedge funds or exchanges who just want to expand their business. Mm-hmm. And individuals too, yes. We're finding that they want to identify themselves. I thought there would be like anonymous validators, but mm-hmm. not so much. Mm-hmm. It's because of the delegation system where stakeholders can delegate to validators and you want to delegate to those who are trustworthy. Turns out everyone kind of ends up wanting to declare who they are. Mm-hmm. It's interesting.
Do you think that a lot of the blockchain and crypto work that's being done today can have an impact on some of the privacy stuff?
Yeah.
You think so? The reason why I'm asking is... Take proof of work, take Bitcoin, for example, right? There is a pseudonymous aspect of it, right? So there's a wallet address. I don't know that you, right, as a human own that wallet address, but I know somebody owns the wallet address and has a identifier, right, in terms of the wallet address itself. And I can watch what goes in and out of that wallet address. And so that pseudonymous aspect isn't very private. It's actually completely transparent. And if you were to ask, let's say, law enforcement, for example, they would love for criminals to use digital currencies like Bitcoin compared to hard cash, right? Mm. How do we, in our heads, kind of balance that, right? Because I agree, mm-hmm. like things like decentralized systems are probably mm-hmm. more secure in many cases.
Yeah.
But then something like financial surveillance, maybe it's easier with Bitcoin. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Compared to cash, but maybe mm-hmm. it's less easy than the traditional financial system, for example.
Mm-hmm. You know, I see a need for anonymization.
Okay.
People need privacy for you know, certain transactions. They're not always breaking the law, but they don't want people to know everything that they're up to, especially like businesses who want to make a transaction, but don't want the whole world to know what exactly they're doing, right? Because they have a competitive edge there. I think the Cosmos network and the architecture or the network that it's building out may hold some answers here. So, for example, the Cosmos Hub itself, it's a multi-asset proof-of-stake system with many tokens that can be on there eventually. But it's like you mentioned, pseudonymous. All the accounts, everything is public and transparent. You just don't necessarily know who it is. But when you have blockchains that provide additional privacy features connect to it, then I think the conversation will evolve toward gateways, right? So it may be that initially, I'm just going to draw a scenario. Maybe this isn't what's going to happen. But there might be blockchains, for example, Zcash-like chains or other BLS crypto-based chains or zero-knowledge chains that provide privacy and that they explicitly provide. That's why they exist. And they connect to the Cosmos Hub. And maybe we'll see a lot of people use it. But eventually, when people see that, when people can tell that that blockchain is being used towards evil, say, maybe something bad is happening, then there's going to be demand to figure out a way to put a throttle on that, for example. Or it may be that regulators say these gateways are the ones that need to be regulated. So they might have rules about whether you're allowed to put money into those privacy zones, say. So I think that's maybe where the conversation will end.
This is interesting. What's the future look like, Cosmos and Tendermint? What are you guys working on right now?
Right now, we're working on IBC. So there's what's the Cosmos that? SDK, which is a blockchain framework written in Go that allows you to very easily create a production-level blockchain in Go that also is powered by Tendermint. You don't have to use the Cosmos SDK. There are other frameworks like Lotion is one in JavaScript that also ties into Tendermint. When we're developing the IBC spec now, so IBC will soon be an implemented module in the SDK. So people who are building on the Cosmos SDK now will be able to connect to the Cosmos Hub very easily when that's released in a matter of months.
What's IBC stand for?
Inter-blockchain communication. It's kind of like TCP/IP for packets. So I would say, here's the analogy that I like to draw. Tendermint is like an operating system, like Windows or OS X, except what it does is it allows distributed replication of a computer. You know, so a blockchain to me is just a replicated computer. IBC is like TCP/IP between distributed computers. Cosmos is like the World Wide Web.
Got it. Before we finish up, I have rapid fire questions. You don't have to answer quickly.
Okay.
Most important company in crypto? Can't say yourself.
Can't say myself. Most important company in crypto.
You're coming in here talking about cow farts and all this other stuff, and I just stumped you with the most important company in crypto.
Dude. What kind of question is that? the Fed.
The Fed?
Yeah, it's a Why? Private company, right?
It is.
Yeah. Why? Because they're going to eventually, when cryptocurrencies and this ecosystem gets more and more widespread adoption, they are going to want to figure out a way to limit that because it's taking power away from the, you know, the consortium of banks, essentially.
All right. That's actually a really interesting answer. No one's ever said that. Usually people just say like Coinbase or Facebook. What would be the one regulation that you would change or improve if you could?
You know, let me think. You know, I think for one, the SEC is doing a pretty good job.
Agreed.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by like how much detail they go into in trying to analyze something and they're trying to create a good framework. So I love that about them. But what can be improved? I think better clarity would be nice. Like right now, there's no incentive for companies to go out and reach out to them. It's almost like the lawyers tell you not to, because if you're in the radar, then you're, I guess, potentially more likely to get some kind of penalized or somehow, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, we haven't really had a conversation with the SEC, but I wish we could mm-hmm. somehow. Yeah. Maybe there should be some framework for having that conversation.
That makes sense. Normally I ask people what their most controversial thought in crypto is, but I want to know what's your most controversial thought in life. What's the one thing you believe that everyone else disagrees with you on? This is my favorite part of the interview, is when I ask questions and people sit there and just stare into space and think.
How much time do I have?
Unlimited time.
Are you sure? Isn't this live or something?
No.
Okay.
It's never a good thing when I ask a question, somebody asks me, how much time do I have?
This might not be controversial.
It's okay.
Okay. I think, so I'm kind of like a... I don't subscribe very much to like ideologies anymore, but I used to be a libertarian, and I used to be interested in voluntarism and copyism, you know. And,
what are those?
Voluntarism is the idea that that systems should not enforce policies through violence or okay. you know, penalty of jail, say, but that say, for example, through the marketplace or through just providing better choices, incentivize people to adopt, you know, doing certain things, right? Copyism is it's kind of like a faux religion started by, I don't know, if you look at the Wikipedia page, it's funny. It says it's started by a 19-year-old something, nice Swedish philosopher or something like that. But the idea there is you don't want to enforce intellectual property right laws, but that information should be allowed to be copied for free, you know, without penalty. And I do still subscribe mostly to that. I think in the future, through crypto and blockchains, and especially the governance systems or decision-making systems that make use of the capital that can be generated from blockchain systems through like inflationary tokens, say, as an example, we will see more alternatives to services offered traditionally by governments or local governments. And that eventually the blockchain movement will make the world more voluntary so that you can choose what kind of system you want to live under. And people will choose this based on what kind of tokens they hold in their wallet.
I mean, look, Bitcoin is a form of that today, right? If you just look at currencies, there's an inflationary fiat-based currency that's backed by and or run by, you know, the monetary policy of the Federal Reserve, right? Mm-hmm. There's another one that is a disinflationary, decentralized, algorithmic, you know, whatever currency, right? People have choice between those two things. You could make the argument that money is a service that the government or government entities provides, right? And so if Bitcoin gains mass global adoption, it replaced it, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's already true.
Yeah. And I think that you wouldn't be, if you knew it with money, right? Other services all of a sudden don't seem that big of a deal, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. What's the most important book you've ever read?
I like The Master Switch. No, that's a pretty good book. It's about the evolution of the telephone system and the internet. Here's another one. Principles by Ray Dalio.
Fantastic.
I really like that book. Yeah. We're trying to push that as much as we can. I think people should embrace honesty, transparency, mm-hmm. and just always try to improve one another.
He's a big that U.S. dollar's in trouble guy. He's been really pounding the table lately, saying that you know, no one's paying attention, and hey, this thing's going to suffer a lot more than people think.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. What about aliens? You believe?
Oh, okay. So, this is getting weird now. All right.
This is getting weird now. That's the best response to the alien question we've gotten so far.
All right.
Ask everybody the alien question. All right, you know, it's special.
Okay. I think there are aliens out there and other civilizations. Why? Because, I think at this point we even know that there's life on Mars, right? So just a fact, life, I think. Did you know that there's like life like way down in the crust of the Earth where like you wouldn't imagine life to be? Mm-hmm. So like cells are amazing. Wait, hold
on. Life on Mars. Explain.
Recently there was a lot more evidence. More evidence came out about life on Mars. Mm-hmm. So what was it? It was like
I thought they found like methane. Some kind of like water. Some sort of.
I think it was.
It wasn't intelligent life. No, it was just something they didn't believe had existed on Mars. They've now discovered.
Right. So I think Pangea or something. Mm-hmm. The theory that life is all around in the universe. I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. I also happen to think we're in a simulation, so I do subscribe to that.
Really?
Yeah. You know, so I think about the world in terms of multiverse. Mm-hmm. And it can be quite weird because you're thinking about not only your life now in this track, but also all the possible other, you know, tracks and places that you could be at, and that they all exist simultaneously, you know? So that kind of changes your perception of who you are as an individual, you know? So I think compared to other people, I think less about myself as this being in a body, mm-hmm. more so as a, I don't know, just energy or just this thing that also is interconnected to everyone else in the world.
Did you see recently this new state that was discovered in terms of when I was in high school, right? I didn't take a lot of science classes, but I remember a couple of things. And one of them was there's liquids, solids, and gases. Mm-hmm. There's only three of them. Mm-hmm. They've now identified and confirmed a fourth state, which is a liquid solid. So there's now a liquid, mm-hmm. there's a solid, there's a gas, mm-hmm. and there's a liquid solid.
Okay, yeah.
And it's fascinating to me that in, what, you know, 15, 20 years, we can go in such incredible breakthroughs in science that drastically change the way that we think about material, mm-hmm. right? Like atoms. Mm-hmm. And there's now, we go from three to four states of being, if you will. And then you look at things on like Mars where, what the heck is there? I don't know. It's methane. Is it water? Is it something else? It's all just a bunch of molecules that are grouped together.
Don't you think maybe like molecules, maybe like subatomic particles themselves might be composed of life? Like, I feel like maybe like electrons are just some kind of, you know, commodity produced by some company somewhere.
It's possible. Yeah. They
Why
would
are
be,
they all the same?
Well, electrons and different types of molecules, I guess, are some are like pixels on a screen. It was, you know, the way we would think of a simulation, it would just be pixels. You would just take those pixels and you'd make up people, things.
Yeah, I mean, I think the phenomenon of molecules might be like macroeconomic phenomenon of like little tiny creatures. I'm serious. Okay, so that's the one.
You are not serious.
I'm so serious. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
What if you believe that and you're right? What changes?
What changes? It means. If that were right, you know, look, I'm not saying that's right. I'm just entertaining that thought in my head. I can't get it out of my head.
All right.
But if that's right, it would mean that, I don't know, that life is recursive, that that there's a purpose to why we're here, mm-hmm. and that the things that we end up doing ultimately also enable and ultimately, you know, make all of this possible, you know? So I feel like in that sense, maybe life has a purpose.
Probably.
Probably.
What do you think the purpose of life is? Somebody asked me this today and I had an answer, so I want to hear your answer and then I'll tell you what I told them.
There's a purpose of life. Well, you know, like I said, I can't get the thought out of my head. I feel like the purpose of life is to do what we're kind of almost designed to do, and such that in the metaverse, everything works to enable even, you know, this coffee cup.
Yeah, but you're thinking more like in the macro physical sense. right? Like the way I answered it was I said, basically just to have fun and be happy, which is more the micro psychological perspective.
I don't have enough of that where I don't think about myself, but I'm trying to change that myself.
Yeah, just go travel some, you'll be all right.
I don't like airplanes.
No? Yeah. Why? Yeah.
Carbon dioxide.
Oh, you know how much fuel
that is?
Yeah, but listen, if they fly to Davos and they talk about saving the world on their planes, it should be okay, right?
I feel guilty every time I get on a plane.
Really?
Yeah.
What about the, do you see a boom?
What boom?
No, the company Boom in San Francisco.
No.
I think they're based in San Francisco.
What is it?
It's a supersonic electric plane.
Okay.
Basically, they're saying that they think that they can make you get on a plane and not feel guilty.
Well, I wish they would also describe all the mining required to get all those, you know, those metals and so on. Like, there's not enough comprehensive, like, that's what, you're kind of getting back to what I was saying earlier. We don't have enough information. So everyone's kind of stumbling in the dark and touching parts of the elephant, not seeing the whole picture.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish I could fix that.
Humans aren't really that smart.
You know, like, what should we call the next species that evolves from us?
I'm not going to be around. You know, a book, have you ever read Guns, Germs, and Steel?
Yeah, it was like required reading for me.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah. That one, though, is when I think of like evolution, I always think of that book and like the whole idea of, yeah, humans are, we're screwed. Like, when, you know, you've seen Boston Dynamics with the robots.
Mm.
And like the flips, and they can pick stuff up. They're better than us already.
You know, I feel like James Cameron is like this arm of information that went back to the past from the future to warn us about what's coming. And I feel like James Cameron is a prophet, perhaps. And that shit is coming.
I mean, The Matrix, all the things he's done, Black Mirror. So looking at all of it, like, it's pretty real.
Yeah, it's scary.
Before we end, you could ask me one question. What do you want to ask me?
Okay. Well, someone's already asked you about your purpose in life, right? You've already
answered
that.
They asked me about my purpose, just the purpose of humans.
Okay. Where would you like to see, let's say, you know, as a host in this program, you have influence.
You just made it sound way more serious than it is. As a host at the program.
Okay.
You hear that, listeners? It's a program.
It's a program, yeah. It's a professional operation here. It's quite tidy. You know, you have power. You have energy. Where would you like to direct the energy towards?
I think that people are being really, really, really short-term or short-sighted when it comes to all this stuff. And I just pound the table over and over and over again that this stuff is all about automation. And it's the machines and the algorithms are going to do a lot of the work, but the existing assets are non-compatible, right? In terms of, we can't use kind of the paper or the electronic assets that we currently have today. And so if we can get people to understand that, I think it puts us in a much better position. And the second thing is, like, you probably would go on a lot of podcasts or talk to folks and they would just ask you about, like, tell me about Cosmos, tell me about Tendermint, and, you know, like, what do you think about Bitcoin and blockchain? And it's just like, that's like such a one-sided conversation, but obviously you have other interests, you have other things that, like, you spend time thinking about or doing. And so I try to, like, remind people that the individuals are so multifaceted. And I actually think there's more overlap with the work that you do professionally and, like, your interest in, let's say, the environmental issues or the surveillance and security stuff, right? Like, all of that goes into informing the decisions you make. And so, like, let's say you make a decision tomorrow, right, that hurts Cosmos or Tendermint, right? If people understand the perspective that you have, like, I think that that is better for you and for them. But most people don't ever, like, have the confidence or the opportunity to just be authentic. Like, you said some crazy shit today. I appreciate that.
Of course. Thank you for asking.
Like, yeah. Like, it's what you believe or what you think, right? So let people just be themselves, and I think the world's a better place.
Yeah. More transparency.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. All right. We're going to do this again, and we're going to talk about really weird shit next time.
I'll be prepared.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.